ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
Good morning on 1180 WFYL's We the People, the Constitution Matters. You could call in on this program. It's all about the Constitution, what it means for today, and we talk about current events in the news and how it all impacts what our Constitution means. Call in at 610-539-TALK. That's 610-539-8255, or toll free at 1-877-667-1180. That's 1-877-667-1180. 1180. I'm Michael Levins. We have also joining us Gary Porter and Phil Duffy this morning. Gary, how are you on this wonderful Friday morning?
Wonderful, Mike, and it's wonderful here in Yorktown. We've got a great spring day to look forward to. So, the topic today is this Convention of the States debate that I attended recently over at Regent University. Are you familiar with the Federalist Society?
Myself, I am somewhat, yes.
Well, they do some good work, and I think they're one of these overlooked organizations. I don't think they have the membership that they deserve, but they have chapters all over the United States, and mostly lawyers. But I don't think you don't have to be a lawyer to be a member of the Federalist Society, but. As the name suggests, they are all about federalism and the correct interpretation of the Constitution. So they sponsor events like this debate, and I think it's an important event, an important debate, certainly. More people around the United States should be having and attending these kinds of debates right now. The subject was a convention of the states, and the two gentlemen who participated in the debate were Virginia Delegate Bob Marshall, who's, I think, a 19-year veteran of the Virginia Assembly, and Patrick Henry Chancellor Michael Ferris, who's also the Executive Director of the Home School Legal Defense Association, the founder and director of that. So both these men have great pedigrees and great experience in constitutional issues, and both great conservatives and Christians. And they've been friends for a long time, and now they find themselves on opposite sides of this particular issue. So they, from time to time, are invited to debate it. And this was not the first time I had heard them. Last fall, I had heard them debate the same topic up at Northern Virginia. But it was close by, so I decided to go over and hear them again. Maybe they would each have some sort of new argument that I hadn't been exposed to before, but I didn't hear a whole lot new. In fact, both of them disappointed me a bit in that I didn't think they took advantage of the time they'd been given to really hit home on the arguments of why a convention of the states is an appropriate mechanism to remedy some of the gross usurpation of power that the federal government has taken upon itself over the last decades and scores of years.
Now, Phil, did you have a chance to attend this debate?
No, I was not at the debate, but Gary has filled me in on it.
But other than that, I'm not aware of what went on.
I remember Gary.
Well, here's a question for Phil.
Sure.
Phil, have you attended any debates on the convention of the state topic there in your area?
No, I have not.
Well, we need to remedy that. Go ahead, Mike.
No, well,
I've been involved,
reading...
but no, I can't say that I've seen any of the debates. I've seen some of the presentations, the one side, if you will, at a time. But no, I haven't been involved or seen any of the debates.
Well, I'm reading your essay, Gary, and it says that you'll admit that you had an upfront bias as far as to the argument. What was that bias? And the convention of the states, a listener for the first time tuning in, again, you're at We the People, the Constitution Matters on 1180 WFYL. You can call in at 610-539-TALK. That's 610-539-8255. But they may not necessarily know fully what the convention of the states means constitutionally. So, Gary, would you care to elaborate?
Oh, sure. That's a great question. We need to cover that ground for sure. Article 5 of the Constitution provides two different mechanisms for amending the Constitution. One of those is for Congress to debate and pass a proposed amendment with a two-thirds vote of each House. And if such a proposed amendment passes both houses of Congress, then it will be sent out to the states for ratification. And ratification will require 38 states, three-quarters of the 50, to ratify the amendment. And we've done that 27 times. You know, there are 27 amendments to the current Constitution. But the second mechanism in Article 5 was given us by George Mason, Virginian George Mason, who I love to quote, but he noted on the almost last day of the Philadelphia Convention that there was only this one mechanism for amending the Constitution. Congress had the sole power to initiate a proposed amendment, and if Congress decided not to initiate, then there was nothing for the states to do except wait for Congress. So he said, gentlemen, what if Congress becomes oppressive, as we all know that is possible? What if they become oppressive and fail to do their duty to propose amendments that are needful and timely? There needs to be this second mechanism. So now we have a mechanism in Article 5, which states that the 50 states or the states can, upon application of the Congress, when two-thirds of them apply to Congress for a convention, Congress is required, Congress must then convene a convention for the purpose of the states getting together and discussing proposed amendments, passing them in a majority vote of the convention, like they did in every convention that we've ever had. And then when the proposed amendments pass the convention, then they are sent by Congress back out to the states for ratification, and they must be again ratified by three-quarters of the states. So we call that a convention of the states because it is the states who are attending through their delegations, although a more proper term would probably be an Article 5 convention because that's the authority for conducting it found in Article 5 of the Constitution.
If I could interrupt here for just a second.
Am I biased in this issue? Well, a short Reader's Digest condensed version is that a year ago I found myself on opposite side of this issue than I do today. I was dead set against the idea of a convention of the states. I had read superficially, at least, some of the arguments about why a convention might be dangerous, and I had actually gone to Richmond, Virginia, on what we call lobby day here, where most people who have issues to get through to the assembly's attention actually go up and visit their delegates and senators and lobby, and so I actually lobbied against a convention of the states that day, but a week later, I was able to attend a presentation by Michael Ferris of the Convention of the States Project and also of Patrick Henry College, as I said earlier. And he outlined for the first time for me what the actual Convention of the States Project's plan is. And I went home from that meeting, did more research, and I concluded that my initial position on the issue had been faulty and that it was something worthy of support. So I've been supporting it ever since, and I've written many newspaper columns and essays on this issue and answered others, you know, as posting comments. So that's in by way of background then, this debate that I attended was pretty much the same arguments that I'd heard before. Michael Ferris basically said that it's going to take more than just electing good people to office, as most people who oppose the convention will contend is the primary objective. It's going to take more than that. As he said, the framers of the Constitution thought that three things were critical to good government: good policy, good structure, and good people. And on the other side, then, Bob Marshall basically contended that all you need is good people, that if we can just get good people elected to office, that all the problems that we face will sooner or later work themselves out.
Now, Phil, you wanted to contribute something before. Go ahead.
Okay, I think what I'd like to do is just to go through the exact wording, pulling out the part about Congress proposing amendments, because I think it's enlightening. The Congress, on the application of the legislatures of two-thirds of the several states, shall call a convention for proposing amendments, which shall be valid to all intents and purposes as part of this Constitution when ratified by the legislatures of three-fourths of the several states or by conventions in three-fourths thereof, as the one or the other mode of ratification may be proposed by Congress, provided that no state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate.
So can you digest that for us a little bit?
Yes. I mean, basically, the first part is what Gary has talked about, and the only additional thought here is that no state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate. I can't picture why a state would come to the convention and elect not to be a part of the union or to be a part of some other state in the future or some other mechanism, but I suppose stranger things have happened. But nonetheless, the basic idea is that there must be an application to legislatures of two-thirds of the several states, that the convention shall be valid to all intents and purposes for proposing the amendments, and in a sense, you can't run away in the convention itself. You still have to go through the ratification process, and Congress has the power to determine which method of ratification will be used. But still, it's going to be three-fourths of the states either way. I think that's the essence of the thing.
And now that we understand a little bit more thoroughly the convention of the states and how that's done, what that means. It is enacted by Article 5 of the Constitution. And by the way, if you're just joining us, we have Mr. Gary Porter, Executive Director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative in Yorktown, Virginia, with us on the phone as a host. And then we also have Phil Duffy with us on the phone. You could call in at 610-539-TALK. That's 610-539-8255, or toll free at 1-877-667-1180. That's 1-877-667-1180. So Gary, someone may be listening and going, okay, now that we know this all about the Constitution, so what? What is the application?
Well, let's point out one other feature that's important here. As Phil just read, it takes applications from two-thirds of the states, or 32 states. Well, we've had over the years more than 340, 350, I think the number is, applications from the states to Congress to hold a convention. Now, why haven't we had a convention? We certainly have not. And so the issue here is, what is it that the states are doing wrong or the Congress is doing wrong, one or the other, that has kept us from having a convention when we've clearly met the threshold of 32 applications? Well, the problem is that the applications thus far have been for a myriad of reasons. Michael Ferris pointed out in the debate that 20, the actual number is 19 states, applied to Congress for the specific purpose of reversing Roe v. Wade once back in the late 60s when the Roe v. Wade decision was announced. And, of course, that didn't meet the threshold of 32. And since then, several of those 19 states have rescinded their applications. So the point here is that over the years, many times the states have gotten together and started to apply to Congress for a specific purpose for the convention or a specific amendment to be considered in the convention, but each time they failed to reach the 32 threshold. So over the years, we've had 300 and some applications, but we have never had 32 for the exact same purpose, the exact same recommended amendment. So Congress has never been forced to convene a convention. In fact, we have the 17th amendment today because Congress chose to forward that amendment as the states were nearing the 32 count threshold that would have required a convention. And Congress didn't want a convention to be conducted because such a convention could have considered amendments other than the 17th amendment that the states were requesting. So Congress, to circumvent and cut off at the pass, so to speak, a convention, gave the states the amendment that they were requesting, and therefore the convention was never held. Other times, states have been given the amendment they were requesting well before the 32 threshold was even approached. We have the 26th Amendment, which gave 18-year-olds the right to vote, primarily because the states were petitioning Congress in sufficient numbers that Congress said, okay, you want this amendment, we'll give you this amendment, and then you can ratify it. So the point here is that 32 states have to apply for a convention for the same purpose. Otherwise, Congress, as they have done, can ignore it. And that's why the Convention of the States Project has as part of their protocol that 34 is the exact count. 34 states have to apply for a convention with the same purpose, and the Convention of the States Project insists that the applications be similarly worded. They want a convention for the purposes of imposing fiscal restraints on the federal government, an amendment that would limit the power and jurisdiction of the federal government, or amendments that would impose term limits on federal officials. So without mentioning specific amendments, they have wisely, I think, framed their applications so that they are, in fact, identical. When they reach the threshold of 34, they will be identical applications. And they haven't tied them down to the specific wording of an amendment. They've rather said, we're only going to discuss amendments which meet these three criteria. And that kind of gives the convention a little wiggle room in terms of what they will consider, but only a little wiggle room, because an amendment that, say, would repeal Citizens United, that Supreme Court decision, wouldn't fit that criteria because it wouldn't impose fiscal restraints on the federal government, it wouldn't limit the power and jurisdiction of the federal government, and it wouldn't impose term limits. So certain amendment ideas that are floating around today would not meet the criteria, and therefore they would be, I would think, ruled out of order if they were introduced in such a convention.
So where were today then? You said something before that basically the Congress had circumvented the states with either giving them the amendment without the need for a convention of the states because it was simply just by popular demand. What has happened in the present day where Congress has done the same thing, if not circumvented a convention of the states, but maybe outright ignored them?
Well, we've never had, since 1913, we've never had the states come close to this 34 application threshold. So Congress has never been forced to even consider this. Now, if the Convention of the States project succeeds and we get those 34 applications, then as the Constitution reads, Congress will have no choice. Now, there's another feature of this that we should mention. Over the years, since 1791, when the Bill of Rights was ratified on December 15th, we have had introduced into Congress probably, well more than 5,000 different amendment ideas, and only 33 of those 5,000 actually passed the two-thirds vote of the Congress. So that tells you one thing. That amounts to 0.07% success rate, even getting an amendment through the Congress. So the point here is that it is really, really hard to amend this Constitution. And, of course, that has its pluses and minuses. It gives us great stability, great expectancy, but it also, when changes are needed, it makes it really, really difficult to do that. Congress has a difficult time getting any sort of an amendment idea through a vote of two-thirds of both houses, and the states, likewise, have had a difficult time getting 34 states to rise to the occasion and submit applications that are similarly worded so that Congress has no choice but to act to convene the convention.
Phil, so
yes.
What is the point for present day?
What is the point for
present day?
Why do we need this?
Why do we need this? Well, in my independent estimation, it's because there are enough structural flaws or language flaws in the Constitution that, as Gary has pointed out, if you take the congressional route, it's simply too slow. There are too many things that need to be addressed, in my opinion. And there's a second part of this, I believe, which is that we need some kind of a mechanism to focus the attention of the electorate on constitutionalism. It hasn't happened so far. The people are just abysmally ignorant of the Constitution. And as a result of that, the Republic is in danger. So it does become a mechanism for focusing education, for grabbing the attention of the media, if you will. And basically, the way you can look at this is that there are three outcomes to something like this. But keep in mind the magic numbers of 13 to 37. Up to 13, if you had 13 progressive states, or 12, I should say, if you had 12 progressive states and the remainder were so-called conservative, the conservatives would have their way, and vice versa. The most likely outcome here, you have to be frank about this, is that no amendments will come out of the convention, because the ratification process will give only 13 to 37 state approvals, which is not enough. You have to have 38 in order to ratify these amendments. So these are the alternatives. I think this is where we're at right now. This is the purpose of the Convention of States. Now, Gary has mentioned his bias. In a sense, I have the same bias. Okay, I think that there are enough things that have to be done to correct the Constitution as it stands right now that the Convention of States is the appropriate mechanism, and is the appropriate mechanism for underlining the fact that the states ultimately should have the power that was originally intended. So these are the purposes of having a convention of the states.
Well, we're going to head to a break, but we will return. We're going to go more into the convention of the states and go, all right, well, what can we use it for today? And this Invention of the States project, what are they planning on using it for today? We'll be back on the Constitution Matters, We the People.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Hi, everybody. Phil Valentine here. It's great to be back on the air in Philly, and especially when my show is being broadcast from the Cradle of Liberty, Valley Forge area, home of freedom-loving patriots both in times past and today, right here on WFYL 1180 AM.
1, 2, 3.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Gossett, inviting you to join me for Backstage Jazz. I'll spend an hour each week taking you behind the music and into the lives of America's top jazz musicians. Experience live jazz music and connect with the artists through backstage interviews. Join us right here for this season of Backstage Jazz. Broadcasting Saturday afternoon at 4 and streaming Sunday night at 6 on WFYL.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFYL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
Good morning again on 1180 WFYL's We the People, The Constitution Matters, a show all about the Constitution, helping educate the people on what this wonderful document means and what it means especially for us today. You could call in at 610-539-TALK, that's 610-539-8255, or toll free at 1-877-667-1180, that's 1-877-667-1180. Gary Porter, Executive Director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative, is with us. I'm Michael Evans, and we also have Phil Duffy on the line to talk about the Convention of the States and what exactly that means. We've been setting that up in the first half of the show. Now we're getting to the so what portion. How can this be applied today? How are people trying to apply it? What are the things that maybe we need to change as far as government officials who may be barring this very important constitutional vehicle? So, Gary, I want to throw that to you to begin with. You were talking about off-air on the break about how we really need good elected officials, because there have been some that have, quite frankly, been getting in the way purposefully of this vehicle in the Constitution, the Convention of the States, so that the states' voices can be heard.
Well, yes, Mike, and first of all, I can give you 18 trillion reasons why we need to have a convention of the states, if you catch my drift.
Well, let's hear them then.
That, you know, the biggest problem we face right now is our monumental national debt, and $18 trillion is not an accurate figure when you consider the unfunded liabilities and such. It's probably closer to $200 trillion. Really, there are other things, and I think Phil will concur in this, and there are other things that need to be changed about the Constitution, primarily because the Supreme Court, over the years, has taken the rather ambiguous language that the framers gave us, and, you know, I can't fault them for it. I would have worded some of these things just as ambiguously as they did, but the court has taken that ambiguous language and stretched the original intent of those clauses to where they are now meaningless. And but before we look at some specific clauses, I want to come back to the 17th Amendment. The 17th Amendment destroyed the balance of power, the voice that the states had in the federal government. It just did. And unfortunately, the states asked for it, and I can't fathom what they were thinking of at the time, but in the original design of the Constitution, the states controlled the Senate. The states appointed the senators directly by the state legislatures, and nothing would get through the Senate unless it was agreeable to the states. They had total control over their senators, and if a senator was acting irrationally or inappropriately in terms of his state's needs, then he would be recalled and replaced. So the states were intended to have this check and balance on the federal power in the Senate, and that was destroyed with the 17th Amendment when we went to direct election of senators. So if we are ever going to restore some semblance of the original balance of power in the Constitution, we must repeal the 17th Amendment, and it will never be repealed by Congress. Congress, using the first mechanism of amendment, will never do that. That would never get through a two-thirds vote of the Senate, particularly. So there are certain changes that can only be addressed by a convention of the states. And I think Phil would agree that another prime target would be the Commerce Clause. The Commerce Clause today means that Congress can enact regulations that affect any business doing anything anywhere, whether or not those products of that business ever cross state lines. And that was certainly not the intent of the framers. Would you agree, Phil?
Yes, I definitely agree on the Commerce Clause. I think an easier clause would be the General Welfare Clause. I've even proposed some language for that, General Welfare as enumerated in this Constitution. That would eliminate a lot of mischief. So there are at least two language things that have to be resolved. I would also excise the necessary and proper clause. That is the purpose of all legislative bodies. That becomes redundant, and that too has been a basis for some judicial mischief. Then there is the issue of the natural born citizen requirement for the presidency, which is not defined. That could easily be defined. I would recommend the law of nations definition in that case, which is that the father must be a citizen. That seems a lot more appropriate today than the anchor baby possibility that we get with the alternative that we're using today. So those are the language things that I would go at, and I think they're terribly important. Now, speaking of language and ideas, I think, Gary, you mentioned that there were three areas that were in this common language for application for a convention of the states, one being fiscal constraints. We're all for fiscal constraints, so that's easy. Limited government, that's easy. And then term limits. And I think there is a potential problem. That divides the people who would be for a convention of states into those who support it absolutely and those who support it conditionally, like myself.
And as you point out, Phil, that just because that is part of the criteria for acceptable amendments at a convention, it doesn't mean, and in fact you've pointed out why it probably would not rise to the level of being passed through the convention. If there's not sufficient overwhelming support for it in the convention, and I agree that a lot of people would see it as not only unnecessary but counter to Republican principles to have that in place. So it wouldn't come out of a convention. And so it's only there to allow the convention to discuss it, and if there's sufficient support, then to pass an amendment through the convention that would then be ratified or not ratified.
I still have concerns about going into the convention with that language.
So the danger is not that something bad will come out of the convention. It's just that whatever comes out of the convention must still be ratified by 38 states. And if there's not sufficient support in the American people for term limits, then it's not going to happen. It's as simple as that.
So I think the issue of term limits has to be consider two possibilities. One, we know there's a severe problem in the judicial area, And I wouldn't oppose that at all. I mean, anything that we could do to rein in judicial power, I think, would be worthwhile. However, when you start to tamper with the legislative branch, the representatives of the people, it seems to me that we're tampering with a basic principle of government. One of the underlying themes of the Constitution. That doesn't seem like the direction we ought to go in.
And well, I agree that term limits on elected officials, there's probably not sufficient support for that. But I think the primary target of that area of discussion would be term limits on federal judges. Sort of a term limit, even as long as 25 years or 30 years, something that would define the point at which this federal judge needs to step down and let somebody else take his place.
Yeah, and my suggestion is go into the convention states with clean statements and make sure that there's nothing that implies that the purpose of going in is to pass these limited amendments. I've got another one that I have reservations about, and that is the so-called balanced budget amendment. If the Constitution is followed, you don't have a problem with balancing the budget because you can't expend funds for things that are not enumerated in the Constitution. It seems to me that when we try to go at something like a balanced budget amendment, we end up writing an amendment that is so confusing and so opportunity-laden for lawyers that it defeats its purpose. And so I would like to see those things cleaned out going into the convention, and then we could focus our attention on the structural issues that some of which I've discussed. Now, I haven't discussed all of them because we really have to look at Article 3, and the fact that it's just so incomplete right now that the judiciary can run amok.
Well, and they have, too. Sorry, I lost my feed there for a while, so I missed part of your conversation. But I agree with you that Article 3, it was almost seemed like an afterthought. And that's the powers that were given to the judiciary in Article 3 were so skimpy that Hamilton framed it the least dangerous branch because they wouldn't have anything to do. And as we know, that has turned out to be exactly the opposite. They have been the most dangerous branch to originalism and original interpretation.
Gentlemen, if I may join in, I also would care to think of why did they not put a term limit on the judicial branch, any part of the judicial branch, in the first place? What may have been the thought of the framers behind that? That's the obvious question, it seems to me.
Right, easily answered because they did debate this in the convention, and they wanted the judicial branch to be completely free of influence and as separated from the political process as possible. So that's why they came up with what we have now, is that they serve essentially for good behavior, which in most cases means for life. But as we've seen in practice, then when we get a judge in position, a justice in the Supreme Court, who has very radical views of where this nation should be going socially, as many justices have, then we're stuck with that. We're stuck with that person and in that position until they either die or retire. It is impossible to remove a justice for their opinions that they render. Even as wild as those opinions may be, we have never had a justice impeached for their judicial opinions, only for personal misconduct.
Phil, I want to go to you on that. There are so many justices that people basically go to if they want a particular issue judged the way they think they're going to rule. Basically, they know the judge's opinion on something, and they'll go to this district court or this district court because they know that a particular judge will rule a certain way. How can we, is there any way constitutionally to fix it? I think, Gary, you answered that question, but Phil, is there anything we're missing?
Well, I think that it's a very, very difficult challenge to begin with. But I think the answer is in understanding the culture, the judicial culture. Right now, it's a free-for-all. The idea of the general welfare has been just totally distorted, turned on its head. Interstate commerce, likewise. So the basic idea here, I think, is to first of all send a signal to the judiciary by changing the language of the Constitution that says that the general welfare is the general welfare as enumerated in this Constitution. It's not the general welfare as some judge decides as he wakes up in the morning. If we can get back, if we can start to focus the attention not only of the judiciary, but also of the citizenry on the nature of the Constitution, then I think there is some hope that we'll get some more sensible decisions coming out of the Supreme Court and federal courts that are consistent with the Constitution.
And the point here is that the judiciary is never going to make these reforms themselves, neither is Congress. And Mike Ferris, in this debate I attended, pointed out that Senator Tom Coburn, who is the famous author each year of what he called the Pig Book, which was a compilation of all the wasteful government spending, Tom Coburn, despite all his efforts, was never able to get any of those wasteful projects defeated in Congress. Every one of them that he pointed out went through and got completed and obligated and the money spent. So Congress shows a great inability to reform itself and to spend money wisely. And so the point is, are you going to force Congress through a change of the wording of the General Welfare Clause to mend their ways, or are you going to somehow elect 535 responsible adults to Congress?
And you would suggest in your essay, Gary, that it is to elect, and it shouldn't be insane, as your article is titled, actually. This is the essay that you release weekly. It says, is that insanity? And your point is, or is this insanity? And your point is it that much to ask that we should have responsible, competent officials? I mean, for example, a financial advisor is bound by law to have a fiduciary trust with their clients or prospects. They have to act within the client or prospect's best interest. And again, they have that fiduciary trust, and that's exactly what fiduciary means. They have to act for their client's best interest, and they can actually be held accountable in a court of law if they recommend a product or service, again, financial services, so life insurance or a mutual fund or something. They can be held accountable if they recommend something that is not in the best interest of their client, and they could be prosecuted for that. They could really get in trouble. Why not with our representatives?
Any financial advisor who put his client in $18 trillion worth of debt would have been run out of town on a rail. But but we see that as business as usual. Remember that every penny of that $18 trillion in debt was obligated by the Congress. Now they may point fingers at the president for a deficit budget, but Congress had to obligate every penny of that.
So basically, they had to approve it, is what you're saying?
Absolutely, they had to appropriate every penny as required by the Constitution. I might point out, they had to appropriate every penny of that $18 trillion worth of debt.
And doing so, they were basically kicking the can down the road yet again, as Washington is so famous for, because they are not coming together collectively to act for the benefit of the people of the nation.
Right. Individually, we are very good at electing good people. I mean, everybody tries to elect, I'm sure, the person they think is best qualified, best suited to the job. We don't send people up there who we know are going to do a bad job. That's not the point. So, but when they get up there, it seems like there's a lobotomy that takes place, and they suddenly lose their fiduciary responsibilities. And
I like that choice of that verbiage, lobotomy. Yeah, it would seem that way sometimes, wouldn't it?
Well, how else can you characterize the result?
Mike, may I make a comment related to this? There's this balance of power thing that we have in Washington, and I think most of us would agree that the balance of power has moved very, very strongly towards the executive over the years. Mm. There is a problem there. And to me, one of the things that has to be dealt with in a convention of the states is the executive veto. Now, this was an idea that Franklin thought was bad to begin with. He identified the fact that not all presidents were going to be George Washington. And really, when you look at what we've got today, essentially, one person who is not elected to legislate can overrule 355 individuals who have been elected to legislate.
Hmm.
That's the mathematics of the executive veto today.
Right.
So that has to be reversed. When you reverse that, you reverse the idea that the executive is driving legislation, which is the mentality. You know, it comes out of the annual address by the president. You know, here's my program. Well, now the responsibility should be under the legislature, and it becomes much, much more apparent that they are fully responsible for the $18 trillion that Gary is talking about.
Well, then you go back, though, to Blackstone's view that the legislature is the preeminent body of the government. And I don't think the framers saw it that way. And so they gave us the mechanism in the Constitution of being able to override the presidential veto. But that two-thirds vote that would override the veto is a high margin, and it's a high barrier to making the will of the Congress prevail.
And it's a very high barrier how many times has it even been reached in the history of Congress? That's a statistic I would like to know. But with this presidential veto, though, you're right, Phil, the mathematics are simple. You have one vote, essentially, because that's exactly what it is, that overrides however many are make up both the Senate and the House now, because it's divided up differently. Exactly, but the House sometimes states grow, changes hands, of course. But all of those votes can go for nothing with one. Now, what a convention of the states can be used to even amend that, correct?
Certainly.
That is correct, because the only limitation, according to Article 5, is that no state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate. Everything else is up for grabs, which I think is a good idea.
Well, now, you have to consider for a moment, though, if 34 states apply to Congress for the convention and they use the Convention of the States Project language in their applications, then I'm not sure that removing the presidential veto feature would fit in the criteria. Would that reduce the power and jurisdiction of the federal government? It certainly wouldn't impose term limits, and it certainly wouldn't impose fiscal restraints. So would that fit the criteria of the Convention of the States Project application?
In my mind, it would, because what seems to be happening here is that because the executive has such great power, the federal government has much greater power.
That's true, yeah.
And that's something
it might fit.
You get into the age-old argument of, because it's going down that road of, should the federal government have more power? Now, people would agree probably that one person shouldn't have too much power, but when you're talking about the executive, for some reason people don't think of one person having too much power because the executive is a part of the federal government. They just think of giving the federal government more power. Well, if that's going to be the executive, then that's going to be one person who's going to have more power. People don't make that connection sometimes. And how, because honestly, I would love to see a convention of the states to directly address what we've seen President Obama try to do through executive action.
Yep. Well, I think that'd be a worthwhile project for the convention to undertake. And if they can come up with language that a majority of the delegates could agree to, or the majority of the delegations could agree to, then fine. Then it's up to the vote of the people in ratification as to whether we the people want that to be a change to our Constitution. So, you know, there are safeguards, and the basic point is the convention can do nothing on its own except propose changes. If those changes don't meet the approval of the American people, then they go nowhere. And so there's the safety relies that we must rely on lies in the American people. It is their document. It is their document from the get-go, and that's the way it should be.
Phil, we have about 40 seconds. I want you to have the last thought.
I would go with the general welfare phrase. I mean, if you have to start someplace, that's where you start. And I think that just discussing that in the Convention of States and the education that would come as a result of that would take us down the right road.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us on the Constitution Matters, We the People. We'll see you next week on 1180 WFYL.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenboom with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
Driving has a rhythm all its own. Don't wreck it with a text. Before you get behind the wheel, silence your phone. Or better yet, designate a texter. For more text-free driving tips, visit stoptextstopwrecks.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
If you like Car Talk, catch Under the Hood, Saturday and Sunday mornings from 6 to 7. Exclusively streaming on 1180WFYL.com. Worldwide on your computer or mobile device. Stream Under the Hood this Saturday morning from 6 to 7 at 1180WFYL.com or on your favorite mobile device. Go to our website at 1180WFYL.com to find out more.
friends. Janet Parshall here, host of In the Market with Janet Parshall. I'm excited about partnering with 1180 AM WFYL to bring you a fast-paced conversation every Sunday. As you listen to In the Market, we'll examine major news stories and issues, equipping you to be bold when voicing truth in a confused and chaotic culture. I look forward to engaging my new friends at 1180 AM WFYL every Sunday at 12:05 p.m. on In the Market.